Okay then, brethren, I think you understand today we're going to do something a wee bit different, which is a news update of things that may or may not be sort of relevant in the light of Bible prophecy. And of course, I think we all realise there's always plenty of things happening in the world, every day, every week, every month and so on. And I've detected, as you've probably seen it, a tendency among us all at times to jump on certain events as being what we think might be important prophetic indicators. The very first time I came across that in my own life was way back in 1967, which was the time that the Jews recaptured most of Jerusalem, including the Temple Mount area, in the was it Six-Day War. Now, that seemed to be extraordinarily prophetic. What, after two millennia, the Jews once more control the temple area? Wow, what's going to happen now? Probably there's going to be a recommencement of the sacrifices, and they'll be stopped, and the abomination will get up, and all the rest of it. So that seemed to tie in very clearly with a very popular book of the day, 1975 in Prophecy. And it wasn't just the worldwide Church of God that was excited by the Six-Day War. Lots of Christians and Bible believers thought, this is it. Here's clear, absolute proof that we're in the time of the end. Well, that's 50 years ago. So there we go. Then another one was just a few years after, which was the Arab-Israeli War of 1973. That's the war that broke out on Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, when the Arabs, Egyptians, launched their attack against the Jews on the Jews' most holy day, when most of them were actually, of course, on holiday and fasting. Well, seemed very significant, but that was over 40 years ago. Yet it seemed at the time, surely, this is a major prophetic event. Then, of course, moving further forward, we had 9/11, the death of thousands of people, an attack right at the heart of the USA's economic system, New York and so on, a major terrorist event. But even that was, to be fair, 16 years or so back. And you could keep on going. We had the global financial crisis of 2007 and 2008. That was the worst economic collapse since the Great Depression of the 1930s, apparently. We saw a major bank like Lehman Brothers collapsing. Many countries came very close to bankruptcy. Hugely massive event. And many people at the time said, this is prophetic. Well, 10 years or so has elapsed. More recently, we've seen people talking about the Shemitah years, if you've come across that. These are alleged seven-year cycles. So 9/11 was 2001, a time of judgment upon the USA. 7 years later, another Shemitah year brought us to 2008. Oh, the great financial global collapse. 7 more years after that's going to bring us up to 2015. Wow, what will happen then? And one guy called Rabbi Jonathan Kahn had a best-selling book in the New York book thing, The Harbinger, explaining that come 2015, the next Shemitah year would see major upheaval. At the same time, we had 4 blood-red moons, a tetrad of blood-red moons, all coinciding with biblical holy days through 2014 and 15. Wow, first time in 2,000 years, and it's a Shemitah year. Okay, and of course, not a lot happened. So what does this all tell us? Well, it tells us that so far, at least, we've got a pretty good track record of misreading the signs of the times. Hence, we need to be always very cautious, underline very cautious, as we try to analyze and interpret world events. Even the biggest, most exciting, we've not done a terribly good job so far of comprehending them. And that can lead to sort of two extremes in terms of prophecy. On the one hand, there are people who just decide to ignore it all, ignore everything, just get on with their day-to-day lives, pay no regard whatsoever, just ignore it because you can't understand it. On the other extreme, there are those who become obsessed by prophecy and world news and spend their entire life digging around in the internet and adding up days and months and years and jubilees and so on. Well, I don't think either is a particularly good idea. I think you and I need to be a bit more balanced. Okay, let's open our Bibles at Matthew 16. Just a quick reminder from Jesus, Matthew 16, let's read verses 1 to 4. Because Jesus does expect us to pay some interest in what's happening. Matthew 16 and verses 1 through 4. Then the Pharisees and Sadducees came and testing Jesus asked that he would show them a sign from heaven. And let's see something important and relevant. He answered and said to them, when it is evening, you say it will be fair weather for the sky is red. In the morning, you say, it will be foul weather today, for the sky is red and threatening. You hypocrites! You know how to discern the face of the sky, but you cannot discern the signs of the times. So Jesus criticized these guys for not being able to figure out the signs of the times. What we're looking at here is, you know, are there any signs of the times? Is there anything in prophecy that you and I should be alert to that we can see if we've got eyes to see and ears to hear? Or are we like an ostrich with our head buried in the sand? Jesus wasn't very pleased that these guys couldn't discern the real signs of the times. Verse 4, a wicked and adulterous generation seeks after a sign. No sign shall be given it except the sign of the prophet Jonah. And he left them and departed. Let's turn to Matthew 24. Read verses 15 to 18. Matthew 24 is the Olivet prophecy. Very long prophecy. It is a prophecy. So Jesus is talking about the future. You would imagine he hopes people would understand the prophecy and therefore be alerted to what to expect in the future. So let's pick up in verses 15 through 18. Therefore, when you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet standing in the holy place, whoever reads, let him understand. Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. And it's apparently quite urgent. It says, let him who is on the housetop not come down to take anything out of his house. Let him who is in the field not go back to get his clothes. So here's a time of great urgency. Later on it tells us it's the time of the great tribulation. And except those days are cut short, no flesh will be saved. But notice in verse 15, you know, two things we can see here. Jesus says, therefore, when you see the abomination of desolation standing in the holy place. So it's something that can be seen if you are watching. So it implies here that people are watching. The saints are watching, and then they see it. And when they see it, because they've been watching and alert and aren't, you know, totally sidetracked by something else in their lives, when they see it, they think, aha! This is one of the signs that Jesus gave. Jesus says, when you see this particular sign, then those of you in that area get out in a hurry. Do not delay. Don't go back to your house. Just move. Pronto. And notice also in verse 15, when you see the abomination spoken of by Daniel the prophet. Well, so two things. One is you see it because you're alert, watchful and looking, and secondly, you're familiar with the prophets. In this particular case, what's spoken by Daniel the prophet. So clearly, Jesus expects us to be familiar with the prophecies and be watchful, which is what you and I, I guess, are trying to do. And then without turning to them, there's many other warnings that Jesus gave about the risk of deception in the end times. He warned of false prophets and even false Christs. There's a warning later on about people taking the mark of the beast and what will happen if you do. So the prophecies are there in part to warn us of the dangers, warn us to be cautious and to remain alert. And I've said a number of times that you and I should be, we can be very familiar with the narrative of the prophecies. What they actually say, the words that we read, we can be quite familiar with those if we bother to, you know, get our Bibles off the shelf and blow the dust off and read the prophecies. We can read what's there. I admit that the interpretation of the prophecies is somewhat more difficult. But I think we're trying to be as responsible as we can with interpreting them. But we have to admit, I think, that at times we are speculating. Don't think there's anything particularly wrong with speculating as long as you recognise it's speculation. And of course, currently, out there in the world, there are a lot of things happening. US politics is all very different over the last few months. We've got Mr. Donald Trump endeavouring to, you know, drain the swamp and move things forward the direction he wants to go, and meeting all sorts of opposition and obstacles. Where will that take us? Well, every day there's something new. There's the current rhetoric with North Korea, you know, a country run by a lunatic, but a lunatic who's got some sort of nuclear weapons, we think. What's going to happen there in North Korea? Who knows? Over here in the UK, we've got Brexit, as it's referred to, the UK endeavouring to untangle itself from the European Union, and things have got a wee bit acrimonious with our partners across the channel in the past few days. With a French presidential election tomorrow, what will that bring? But we have the country of Greece still on its knees, struggling in tremendous austerity and being bullied quite a lot by the rest of Europe, and particularly Germany. So there's lots of things we can watch. Now, over the last few decades, most of us in the Church of God, and some others as well for that matter, have tended to keep a watchful eye on Europe and the Vatican. All right? We've all had this view that there's going to be a Holy Roman Empire resurrected, the Pope or the Roman Catholic Church or the Vatican are going to work closely with it. Germany is going to dominate this European Union. There's going to, at some point, to be an attack on the USA, Great Britain, other English-speaking countries. And that viewpoint is still, of course, very popular. People such as the Restored Church of God and United Church of God and Philadelphia Church of God and COGWA and all the rest, but others outside the Church of God movement, Hal Lindsey and so on, many people still lean that way. I'm not so sure any longer. And the alternative view, which I've espoused with a number of messages in recent times, has been a belief that there's a much more accurate view of what the scriptures tell us if we look not towards Europe, but towards some Middle East countries. And the book of Daniel has turned out to be, I think, very, very helpful here, because I believe the book of Daniel, which Jesus referred to there in Matthew 24, gives us probably some of the key elements to look for. And what Daniel tells us, I believe, is that Iran, the nation of Iran, will soon launch a major war across much of the Middle East. And that's something that we may see relatively soon. Shortly after that, I believe Daniel shows us that Turkey will launch a major and successful counterattack against Iran. Now, it may seem these countries are a bit far off, particularly if you're in San Diego or San Antonio or Decatur or somewhere. But actually, even though the main direct hostilities may be in the Middle East and North Africa, any major Middle East war in the region of the Persian Gulf will have a massive effect on the rest of the world. You can imagine the collapse of the dollar, major economic chaos across the USA, Europe, Japan, you name it. Now, my suggestion is that you and I should keep an eye on the region of Turkey and Iran. And really, any major developments that we see in those countries is likely to be prophetically significant. And, quite honestly, in the past 3 or 4 weeks, there have been a number of interesting developments in those two countries, Iran and Turkey, which we'll cover so shortly. But let's just remind ourselves of what the scriptures tell us about these countries. Look at Daniel 8. Let's read verses 1 to 4. Daniel chapter 8. And this is where, of course, you can certainly be familiar with the narrative. Now, whether it means what we're suggesting here, okay, slight caveat, but certainly what the words tell us, there's no question that we can know that quite well. So Daniel 8, let's read the first 4 verses. In the 3rd year of the reign of King Belshazzar, a vision appeared to me, Daniel, after the one that appeared to me the first time. I saw in the vision, and it so happened while I was looking that I was in Shushan, the citadel, which is in the province of Elam, and I saw in the vision that I was by the river Ulai. Then I lifted my eyes and saw, and there, standing beside the river, was a ram which had 2 horns, and the 2 horns were high, but one was higher than the other, and the higher one came up last. So here's a ram, 2 horns. Horns tend to symbolize authority, as for example with a king. So this ram has 2 horns. One comes up later. And notice, I saw the ram pushing westward, or the Hebrew says to the sea, westward to the sea coasts, northward and southward, so that no beast could withstand him, nor was there any that could deliver from his hand, but he did according to his will, and became great. So here's a ram, which Daniel's prophecy tells us, this ram is going to go on a charge to the north, to the south, and west towards the sea. And it's going to be powerful and successful, it's going to dominate. Nothing in that region can stand in its way. It will become great. Now, okay, who is this ram? What does this ram symbolize? Look at verse 20. Because it tells us, the ram which you saw having the 2 horns, these are the kings of Media and Persia. Media and Persia is today's Iran. When I was growing up, we still had the Shah of Persia. Now, of course, it was taken over by a revolution in the late 1970s, and now we call it Iran. But it tells us here, Persia, Iran, same beast, obviously. So this ram with the 2 horns that goes on a major war is nothing other than Iran. Okay. And Iran, by the way, just in passing, is the center of what they call Shia Islam. You know, there's 2 broad divisions of Islam, Shia and Sunni. Iran happens to be the center of Shia Islam. And of course, as you'd expect, Shia believes it's the one and only true Islam. Of course, the Sunnis believe the same, so there's a massive amount of hostility. What you've probably got here, I imagine, is the Shia-dominated Iran wanting to go out there and stamp its version of Islam on the Islamic world, which, of course, they see as being Shia. Okay, but when? When is this going to happen? Most commentators will tell you all this stuff happened way back thousands of years ago. Don't think so, guys. Look at verses 16 to 19. And I heard a man's voice between the banks of the Ulai who called and said, Gabriel, the angel, make this man, Daniel, understand the vision. So he came near where I stood, and when he came, I was afraid and fell on my face. But he said to me, understand, son of man, that the vision refers to the time of the end. Okay, that doesn't sound like, 300 BC, does it? Verse 18, now as he was speaking with me, I was in a deep sleep with my face to the ground, but he touched me and stood me upright. And he said, look, I am making known to you, Daniel, what shall happen in the latter time of the indignation, for at the appointed time the end shall be. Or the New American says, at the appointed time of the end. So again, it appears to be suggesting this is at the appointed end, the end time. Now look at verse 26. The angel continues, the vision of the evenings and mornings which was told is true, therefore seal up the vision, for it refers to many days in the future. So if we're right, then the ram's attack across the north and the south and the west is something that will happen in the end times, the latter days. Okay, let's read Daniel 8, 5 to 8, because we've got another player here, which is the male goat or the he-goat. Verses 5 through 8. As I was considering, suddenly a male goat or a he-goat came from the west across the surface of the whole ground without touching the ground, and the goat had a notable horn, a prominent horn, symbol of authority, power, perhaps a king, between his eyes. Now, historically, the commentators say, well, this all belongs to, way back BC. This was Alexander the Great of Greece charging about all those centuries ago, 2,300 years ago. But we just saw that the angel says this is to be sealed up for the end time. So, the he-goat, the male goat, has a counterattack, verse 6. Then he came to the ram that had the two horns, which I'd seen standing beside the river, ran at him with furious power. This is in a rage, this particular he-goat, charging at Iran and going to kick the stuffing out of it. That's what he's going to do. And I saw him confronting the ram. He was moved with rage against him. It's not just a polite disagreement. There's rage and all the rest of it here. Attacked the ram, broke his two horns. There was no power in the ram to withstand him, but he cast him down to the ground and trampled him. And there was no one that could deliver the ram, if they wanted to, from his hand. Therefore the male goat grew very great, and when he became strong, the large horn, this prominent notable horn, was broken. And in place of it, four notable ones came up toward the four winds of heaven, north, south, I guess, east and west. Okay, so we've got this prominent horn, and this he-goat is in a massive counterattack. So who's this? Who's the he-goat? Well, look at verse 21. And the male goat is the kingdom of Greece. The large horn that is between its eyes is the first king. Now, it says Greece in most translations, but the Hebrew is Javan, J-A-V-A-N, or Yavan, if you prefer, which actually, if you look at the old maps, will show you is Western Asia Minor, broadly today's Western Turkey. And the first king is going to be some super-duper powerful leader of an end-time fulfillment of Asia Minor or Turkey. And Turkey, by the way, is Sunni Muslim. Right? Now, Sunnis represent about 90% of all Muslims. Only 10% are Shia. And, of course, the Sunnis believe they are the true Muslims. And the Shias are the Laodicean Muslims. And, of course, vice versa. So what you probably see here, in a sense, is actually a war for Shia-Sunni supremacy. Now, are there any signs? There's quite a few signs of things developing between Iran and Turkey. We'll get them just in a moment. But let's look at one other scripture to tie in. Revelation 13, verses 1 to 5. That'll be our biblical backdrop. Then we'll get on to the news updates, which centre around Turkey, where huge changes are taking place, some significant movements in Iran, and then one possible very speculative comment towards the end of all of that. But let's see one other area that ties in, I think, here, and we'll see it as we go, which is Revelation 13 and verses 1 to 5. Then I stood on the sand of the sea, and I saw a beast rising up out of the sea, having seven heads and ten horns. On his horns, ten crowns, on his heads, a blasphemous name. Now the beast which I saw was like a leopard. His feet were like the feet of a bear, his mouth like the mouth of a lion, and the dragon gave him his power, his throne, and great authority. This appears to be a composite beast from Daniel 7. And now, traditionally, we've sort of seen this as the Holy Roman Empire, with numerous resurrections and so on. I'm suggesting that actually this is not historic, this is yet future and lies shortly ahead of us. Verse 3, I saw one of his heads as if it had been mortally wounded, and his deadly wound was then healed, and the world marvelled and followed the beast. So they worshipped the dragon who gave authority to the beast, and they worshipped the beast, saying, who is like the beast? Who is able to make war with this powerful force? And he was given a mouth speaking great things and blasphemies, and he was given authority to continue for 42 months, during which time, it says, verse 7, he makes war with the saints and overcomes them. Now again, traditionally we've said Holy Roman Empire for 1260 years, so we convert the 42 months into, you know, days and then years. It's all historic. Well, I'm suggesting no, the 3.5 years hasn't arrived yet, and when it does, this will be an Islamic 10-nation empire empowered by the dragon. The dragon would be Satan. And of course, Satan is known popularly in the Islamic world as Allah. And they call him God. Well, he is the God of this world, but Allah is none other than Satan. So this, I'm pretty convinced, is the end-time Islamic empire. But notice verse 3, we'll come back to it shortly. One of the heads had been mortally wounded, but his deadly wound was healed. And I'm suggesting, as I've said before, it's not new stuff, that the deadly wound was the destruction of the Islamic Ottoman Empire. Now, just to remind you, the Ottoman Empire ran for about 600 or so years, a massively long-lived empire. It essentially was based on and controlled by Turkey. It was a huge empire that stretched into Europe, right the way up to Austria, across the Middle East, down into Saudi Arabia, across North Africa, Egypt and so on. It was a massively powerful empire. Ran for 600 plus years. But it was wounded, if you like. It was killed off in 1923. And the caliphate, which was the ruling head of it, was wound up in 1924. From 1923 until round about now, Turkey has been a sort of a democratic republic nation. But we will see in a moment that's all changing very rapidly. And I think we're going to see that the Ottoman Empire is about to be restored or resurrected to its former glories, and its deadly wound is about to be healed. And the current date they're aiming for is 2023. In other words, on the centenary of its deadly wound, 1923, it's going to be resurrected in 2023. Now that's the sort of a biblical sort of backdrop. I think that's pretty much finished looking at the Bible now. So what I want to do is take some time to talk through what appear to be some of the more interesting, more significant developments in Turkey, in the main, some for Iran, and then a little throwaway, somewhat speculative comment towards the end about, would you believe, Albania? If you can find that in the map, you're doing well. Well, let's look at Turkey, first of all. Since 1923, when the Ottoman Empire was pretty much dissolved, Turkey has been a secular country. Nearly 100 years, but its time is running out, I think. Its first sort of leader in his new form is a guy called Mustafa Kemal Atatürk, the father of Turkey, who deliberately set about creating a secular country. Mr. Atatürk has sort of looked around way back in the 1920s and 30s, and he just thought to himself, you know what, if you look at Islamic countries of the day, they're all pretty poor, still medieval. If you look across at Europe and North America, these countries appear to be far more prosperous, and he put the blame on Islam. That was his take on it anyway. So he says, I'm going to change Turkey from being a sort of Islamic-governed country into a more secular-governed country. And he did that, passed all the laws, and designed a structure that would keep Islam out of government control. That's quite, you know, quite a shift. Now, he was quite happy that individuals might remain, you know, Muslims, and that is the case for Turkey. But what he wanted to ensure was that the governing body of Turkey was purely secular, not run according to Islamic principles. And to do that, he set up the army and the military and gave him a clear mandate that if ever the country's government started to move towards trying to be Islamic, the army should step in, there should be a coup, and they should reset the system back to being secular. And over the, I guess, first 80 or so years, the military did that. And that was their job, designed to reset, press the button, get it right back to secular. Well, over the past 10 or 15 years, a new leader, and this is a really, really interesting guy, has turned up. We have referred to him in the past. If you follow the news at all, you'll see plenty of pictures of him. His name is Recep Erdogan, or Erdogan, E-R-D-O-G-A-N. Recep is R-E-C-E-P in our sort of alphabet. Recep Erdogan. Recep Erdogan. He's different. He's very, very, very different. He's got a lot of charisma, and he's on the march. Now, he is a devout Muslim. He is ambitious for himself, but he also has a great ambition to restore Turkey's historic greatness. In other words, to resurrect the Ottoman Empire, with Turkey, obviously, as its chief. And I think with himself as its great and majestic leader, Mr. Erdogan. Now, he was the prime minister for maybe 10 or more years. He's currently their president. All right? And there's a lot you could say about this man. You just get onto, you know, Google or whatever you use for your search engine and stick in Turkey, Erdogan, and just see what comes up. Erdogan. On a personal level, he's just recently, that was 3 years ago, had a palace built for himself. Right, this palace cost about £500 million, so that's probably, what, $900 million, not far off $1 billion for his palace. It has got 1,100 rooms. It's referred to or nicknamed as the White Palace. It spreads over 1.6 square miles. It is 30 times the floor space of the U.S. President's White House. 30 times more space. It is apparently the biggest residential palace in the entire world. And Mr. Erdogan lives there, and his wife. There are over 250 rooms just for the president and his family. Other rooms are, you know, for hosting, you know, dignitaries and guests and other world leaders, but over 250 rooms just for him and his wife. I think a couple of boys as well. The carpets alone cost over £7 million. This place is super opulent. It's got pools, fountains, swimming pools, gold. Just get on to, you know, Google or something, stick in President Erdogan's palace. There are hundreds of photographs of super-duper opulence. He also, by the way, has a few other palaces, the normal Turkish palaces for entertaining dignitaries as well. So I think when you see that palace, you'll get a bit of a feel for what this man thinks of himself and his importance. Now, if you remember, you may remember a major event in Turkey last July. Happened one Friday night, caused lots of excitement, which was an attempted coup by the military, who were doing what they were supposed to do, which is when they see the government shifting towards Islamic, which Mr. Erdogan is. He's a devout Muslim. He has great plans for the resurrection of the Muslim empire. So the military sort of attempted a coup, but apparently it was pretty poorly organized, a bit of a botch. It only lasted a few hours. And some people, in fact, reckon that Erdogan knew it was coming, and the thing might even be a what they call a false flag. So, but it did give Mr. Erdogan justification for a wholesale clear out of anybody that he was concerned about, anybody he thought might oppose him. You've now got a reason. Oh, they've attempted to throw over the legitimate government. These nasty people. I, on behalf of my nation, must clean out all the dross. Got a good reason now, hasn't he? Even if it's a made-up reason. So, last month, 2nd of April, to be exact, their interior minister, Mr. Soylu, S-O-Y-L-U, gave a summary of the current position, what they've done since last July. Apparently, they've detained 113,000 people. That's a lot. 113,000 people. 47,000 are still under arrest. Many of the rest have been released but are under judicial control, have to continue to report. That number includes nearly 11,000 police, 7,500 soldiers, 168 generals. These are the leaders in the military. They've been sacked, suspended, jailed. Over 2,500 judges. These are the guys who ensure that the law is honoured and followed. He's booted 2,500 out. Scores of academics have been expelled from universities. Newspapers, journalists, have been gagged. Last week, about 1 week ago, Wikipedia was shut down. I'm not sure if it's started again yet, but shut down because Mr. Erdogan is controlling what gets reported. And this month, in the month of May, they've announced a further 9,000 police have been suspended. Another 1,000 military officers have been suspended. 485 academics have been booted out. And another 4,000 public employees. Now, the numbers, in a sense, don't matter too much, other than you get the picture, don't you? This guy is enforcing his rule across the country, and any opposition, whether it's real, whether it's imaginary, he's dealing with it. People like academics, people like journalists, TV stations, judges, and might say, well, hang on, no, the government can't do this, it's against the law. Any such people, they're being removed right now. Military men, thousands have been removed. You have to assume these were the guys who would be more likely to try and enforce Mr. Ataturk's mandate. Out. Gone. And on top of that, the comments are that the atmosphere now is even people who might have thought in the past of standing up are too scared because they've seen what's happened to everybody else, being jailed, losing jobs, being silenced. So now everybody is being very cautious. There's very little opposition allowed. So that's the sort of state of play since last July. Mr. Erdogan's used that attempted coup to really strengthen his grip on the country, his judiciary, his military, its education system, communications, media, the lot. Mr. Erdogan is quoted as having said, quotes, "Democracy is like a streetcar. You ride it till you get to your stop and then you get off." So that's his view of democracy. It's just a vehicle to get you to where you want to go. It's a means to an end, and then you do what you want. Okay, fine, and that's what the man's up to. He's not democratic, it's just a means. You can talk democracy and freedom and liberals, just like a streetcar. You take it as long as you want. When you've got to where you want to be, you get off, and after that, you do it your way. In terms of the guy being very much a devout Muslim, he has written a number of poems, some poetry, and here's one of them, or an excerpt from one of them. This is written by Mr. Erdogan. It quotes, "The mosques are our barracks, the domes are helmets, the minarets are bayonets, and the believers are our soldiers. This holy army guards my religion. Almighty, our journey is our destiny. The end is martyrdom." Now, the guy is definitely unusual. Many people are likening him to being a dictator. If he's not a dictator today, they see him being one pretty soon. And some people are now comparing him to Adolf Hitler back in the 1930s. He's using his power to dominate, to silence opposition, and to advance his own position. And yet, even with all of that, he wants more power. If we go back 3 weeks to the 16th of April, that was Easter Day, so quite recent, there was a major referendum in Turkey with Mr. Erdogan looking for more power. Can you believe it? He's not content as yet. He wants the constitution of Turkey changed. Now, this was a major referendum. Mr. Erdogan apparently won it with 51% of the votes against 49%. But as you'd expect, there's a lot of allegations of jiggery-pokery. 1.5 million votes appear to have turned up without any official stamp. All, strangely enough, voting for these changes that Mr. Erdogan wants. So he's got his way. The amendments have been carried. And there are 18 amendments to the Constitution. Here's some of the more important ones. Let's get, I've got four or five here. And you get, again, the gist of what this man's up to. This is, don't forget, only 3 weeks ago. Number three of the 18, the requirement of the Constitution to serve in the armed forces before entering Parliament has been removed. Now, no one who's been in the armed forces can enter Parliament. He's completely reversed it. So the whole idea before was military guys who, if you like, understood Mr. Ataturk's mandate would enter into Parliament, keep a watchful eye there, and be very much neutral. Actually, Mr. Erdogan says, no more. He is now banned. If you've been in the military, you are banned from Parliament. So that's another way of cutting off the ability of the military. And number eight of the 18 amendments to the Constitution, the President, that's Mr. Erdogan, is free to appoint ministers to his cabinet without parliamentary approval. So he has a total authority. Whatever he wants to be in his cabinet, he can just appoint them. Without Parliament saying, not happy or whatever, he could just do it. So therefore, he would be free, if he wanted to appoint, let's say, Islamic fundamentalists to his cabinet. If he wants to do it, he can do it. Number 12, the president of Turkey can issue a state of emergency at will. There's been one since last July, by the way. As many as he wants, as long as he wants. Amendment 14, the president can handpick 4 out of the 13 judges in the highest federal court. Well, you've seen all the fussing in the US of A about Supreme Court and getting a judge that you want there. The president can get 4 of the 13 at his personal choice, which is quite a lot of power in the highest Supreme Court. You only need 7 to get a majority, so he's got 4 of those already. So, job done. So he's going to rule even in the judiciary. And perhaps the last one to comment on, number 17, the new presidential powers all take effect on the 3rd of November 2019. So the referendum has agreed the powers become live and kicking from 2019. And then the president, whoever he may be, but let's suggest the most charismatic leader in Turkey's history, Mr. Erdogan, then gets up to 2 5-year terms to choose. So he can be in power till 2029. So assuming that he wins in 2019 in the presidential election, which he will, he becomes effectively, you could argue, the king of Javan. One commentator says, quotes, "No single man, since the days of the sultans leading the Ottoman Empire, will have had such a concentration of power." So I would suggest that we are looking at the notable horn, the prominent horn of Daniel 8 and verse 8. The he-goat has a notable horn. Mr. Erdogan appears to be that horn. Now, of course, if he's assassinated tomorrow, it'll be somebody else. But currently, this guy is a shoo-in. Now, he probably sees himself as the chosen successor to the sultans of old. Because just after the referendum, so only in the last 2 or 3 weeks, he was seen visiting the tombs of several of the former deceased Ottoman leaders. He was heard singing from the Quran. Makes sense. The guy is a devout Muslim, as he went from one sort of tomb to another. And apparently he spent a lot of time at the tomb of Sultan Selim I. Selim is S-E-L-I-M. So he stopped there for quite a while. Apparently he reached out and touched the caliph's spiritually sacred kaftan. A kaftan is a sort of tunic or a robe. And Selim I's robe has been repaired recently and put back with the guy. So Mr. Erdogan reaches out and touches it. Selim I might be a hero, for all I know, to Mr. Erdogan, because he became caliph of the entire Islamic world back in 1517. And he also was the caliph who conquered Egypt and Mecca and Medina and the entire Middle East. If you want a hero and you want to follow his footsteps, you want to be tied up with Sultan Selim I. And that's where Mr. Erdogan was, with his hands on the Sultan's spiritually sacred kaftan. What is he up to? I guess he's looking for inspiration or comfort. So, Mr. Erdogan is well on his way to becoming the most powerful leader in the Muslim world. He has his eyes on 2023, as I mentioned earlier. It's the centenary of the dissolution of the former Ottoman Empire. And if you go on, again, Google or somewhere, and stick in Turkey 2023 vision, it's official. It's there. Turkey's 2023 vision, the centenary of the dissolution of the Ottoman Empire, is all about the wonderful things it's going to achieve economically, in education, in transport, in foreign policy. I think there'll be a bit more than that. If you think of that Revelation 13:3 comment we saw earlier about the deadly wound, which was to the seventh head of the beast being healed, well, you know, if the Ottoman Empire was the seventh head of that beast, which I've said before, and was wounded in 1923, then if it's going to be healed, you'd think maybe 2023, pretty good time. The centenary, two jubilee periods. Now, every year in Istanbul, which is the big city in Turkey, there is a celebration of its conquest back in 1453. It was up till then called Constantinople. It was the capital of the Roman Empire at that time. But the Muslims conquered it in 1453, and they see that as being the birthplace, the real birth date of the Ottoman Empire, with Istanbul for many years as its capital. Well, 2 years ago, the posters all around Istanbul talking about the anniversary celebrations of the capture of Constantinople had photographs of Mr. Erdogan and his then Prime Minister on these big posters with a headline above them. And this is the celebration, the anniversary of the capture of Constantinople. And the headline above the photographs of these two guys was, I don't know how you pronounce this, it looks like Yeniden Dirilis, Yeniden Yuxelis. I'm sure it's pronounced entirely differently, but the point is, it means resurrection again, rising again. So is this a hint that Istanbul celebrates the birthday of the Ottoman Empire with a public announcement of resurrection again, rising again? Would that constitute the deadly wound being healed by 2023? So if you think about it, there's plenty happening in Turkey. You know, as of 3 weeks ago, Mr. Erdogan has secured power to become the most powerful leader since the days of the Sultans. And I think he stands a very good chance of being that notable horn. Well, okay, that's Turkey. Lots and lots happening there. What about Iran? Well, Iran, not as much happening, but still plenty to ponder. At the end of 2015, going into 2016, President Obama ended 2 decades of economic sanctions against Iran on the promise of them not pursuing their nuclear ambitions. Naive, I suspect. But anyway, that triggered the release of billions of dollars back to Iran. Nobody knows for sure how much. Somewhere between $50 billion up to maybe $150 billion. In addition to which, there was a cash amount of $1.7 billion that America gave to Iran. So what's Iran been doing in the past sort of year to 2 years with all that money? Well, in part, building the military, in part supporting terrorism. But last month, in April, Iranian officials announced that their defense budget has now shot up by 145%. Well, that's over double, that's 2.5 times. So the Iranians are now spending 2.5 times, maybe as much as 3 times, what they used to spend on their military. Thanks to Mr. Obama and the money he's released. They've announced that the military is undergoing massive restructuring to make it, quotes, this is their quotes, a forward-moving force, end quote. Forward-moving force. That sound defensive? Or that sound like an attack force? One aim is to use this money to completely revamp the army from top to bottom. One Iran analyst describes these changes as, quotes, a major shift in Iranian military policy that will allow the Islamic Republic to intervene in the Persian Gulf region. Now this analyst continues, quotes, this is a major policy announcement with far-reaching consequences for foreign policy. So in a nutshell, Iran's got its hands on billions of dollars. They are completely revamping their military in terms of equipment, training, and even their strategy is changing to be more forward-moving. Now, of course, all of this hasn't gone unnoticed in the US of A and some other places. So apparently there's a sort of push in Capitol Hill to reimpose economic sanctions on Iran. Might be a bit late to do that, because Mr. Trump clearly isn't Mr. Obama. And one source in the US says, quotes, the Iranians are rushing to accomplish as much as they can before Congress and the Trump administration get around to reversing Obama's policies. So at the moment they're thinking, well, Donald Trump, the US are tied up with other things. We've got the money. Let's make hay while we can, because perhaps sometime soon America's going to turn back and try and get in our way and stop us. Well, who knows? That might happen, that might not happen. Mr. Trump might have other issues to deal with later in the year or next year, and Iran might continue doing its stuff. In the meantime, Iran is beefing up its military in a major way. Also, Iran is currently fighting in Iraq and Syria. It has some direct forces in those countries. In other areas, it's fighting via its proxies. In Syria, where Damascus is the capital, on the news most weeks, Iran supports Bashar al-Assad. Iran has lost several thousand soldiers, fatalities, and several leading generals, but it's happy to get its get blood on its hands because it supports Bashar al-Assad because he's a fellow Shia. And now Iran appears to have the desire to move forward, forward moving, to seek to establish Shia supremacy over the apostates and other Muslim countries. It has pockets of Shias to the north in Azerbaijan, to the west in Syria, Lebanon, and even eastern Turkey, to the south in Yemen. Now, it does say that Daniel 8, we read there earlier, that the Iran will charge to the north, to the south, and to the west. And it happens that Iran has got pockets of support in the north, the south, and the west. But there's a problem. There appears to be a problem. Turkey is the eighth most powerful military in the world. Out of 126 countries, Turkey is number eight. Tanks, weapons, armies, Iran is number 20. So Turkey is hugely more powerful militarily than Iran. So you could wonder yourself, well, hang on a second, how could Iran, the RAM, expect to launch a ferocious attack with Turkey in the area? It tells us the RAM attacks in the north and the south and the west. Well, going west would take it towards Turkey. It may not necessarily go all the way into Turkey, but perhaps towards the east. But wouldn't the he-goat retaliate at that point? If Turkey is the eighth strongest military nation, wouldn't it just turn around and knock spots off of the RAM? Now, eastern Turkey is largely Shia. I mean, they might be quite happy with Iran's arrival. But would Turkey, a Sunni nation, militarily powerful, just stand by when it's got a very important sultan at its head? That's unthinkable. No way would Turkey and Mr. Erdogan stand by and let Iran run amok. Unless of course, and this is where it gets a bit more speculative, unless Turkey, the he-goat, is already preoccupied with a war somewhere else. If his resources are tied up somewhere else, so that his back is turned, so to speak, and then the ram decides, while Turkey's occupied elsewhere, it launches. It may then take some time for Turkey, the he-goat, to recover, sort out its priorities, get ready, and then mount that counterattack. So here we go with a bit more sort of speculative speculation. I think up till now it's sort of broadly what you might expect. Turkey is on the move. It's becoming very much more a Muslim country, more devout. It's got a leader who is an unusual guy, very arrogant, very charismatic, very colourful, with a dream for a greater Turkey and a resurrection of the Ottoman Empire, that's for sure. Now, whether he's the man to bring it to pass, you know, time will tell, but all the ingredients are there. And Iran, you know, the ram is currently on the march as well. It's using the money it's currently got to strengthen and beef up its military. And it has the desire, I think it believes it's got Allah's mandate, to race out and establish Shia, true Islam, on the nearby countries of the Middle East. So it's ready to roll. The question is, you know, what's going to be the trigger to get these things happening? Which brings me to the, sort of, the last point, I guess, today, which is that perhaps the first sign of such a distraction that might tie up Turkey for a while has just popped up in a sort of visible sense in the last 3 weeks. And it's all based around the problems in that part of Europe known as the Balkans. Now, I don't think we're all very good geographically. I'm not hugely good at geography. And I think at times it's quite handy to have an atlas nearby or get onto, you know, Google Maps or something, have a look around at these places. The Balkans, you might recollect, way back in the 1990s, huge problems in the Balkan nations. This was the breakup of the former Yugoslavia, and I can recollect way back reading the Philadelphia Trumpet, 1994, 1995, 1996, 97, all around that era. Every month, it seemed, there were articles about Bosnia, Serbia, Kosovo, all the wars between the various Balkan countries, at times including massacres. You might remember names like Slobodan Milosevic, Ratko Mladic, Srebrenica. There's a massacre there where 8,000 Muslims were massacred, buried by the loosely Christian Serbs. Slobodan Milosevic was accused of war crimes at The Hague. He actually died in custody. He was accused of genocide. His legacy, as far as I can make out, is something like 200,000 dead in Bosnia. And he appears to have cleansed ethnically by shifting them out of the country about 800,000 Albanians from the country of Kosovo. All very confusing, all a complete mess. So Winston Churchill had trouble with the Balkans over a century ago. He says, you know, they make more history than they're capable of consuming. It's a mad area. And it's never really settled down since the 1990s. It's just, it's calm, but there's definitely not much unity there. There's too much ethnic, too much religious friction. And it looks like it's potentially building back up to a head. Now, to put the Balkans geographically in your mind, the Balkans is a bunch of countries just north of Greece, a little bit northwest of Turkey. So not much gap between them. And the issue that appears to be potentially a trigger revolves around the country of Albania. What do you know about Albania? If you're like me, not a lot. Well, Albania is the only Muslim country in Europe. Right? It's Muslim. I just mentioned 8,000 Muslims were massacred by the Serbs from Serbia. Well, the Albanians are very nervous of their Serbian neighbours. And 3 weeks ago, so again, this is quite recent, the Albanian Prime Minister, a guy called Mr. Edi, that's E-D-I, Edi Rama, R-A-M-A, these things have been understood, I think, sort of below the water level, but for the first time, it's been voiced now, Mr. Edi Rama voiced that Albania, his country, might need to unite with nearby Kosovo, a separate country, but Kosovo is made up of 95% Albanians, and possibly unite with the Albanian part of Macedonia, which is the country to the south, because he's nervous. They've been massacred before, the Muslims. There's no real, you know, warmth and affection between the Balkan nations. The Serbs have got a bit of a history there, I'm afraid. So for security, Mr. Rama thinks that if Europe won't let them join, and that looks a bit unlikely, if the EU does not let them join, then they might have to unite Albania plus Kosovo plus part of Macedonia and create a greater Albania. Now, he's mentioned that. Don't think there's any plans necessarily at this moment in time. But he says, look, to defend us, the only Muslim country in Europe, against, and then he probably, you know, points at Serbia as the main offender, we need numbers. We need to be bigger than we are. So we need to think about forming a greater Albania. Okay, what happens if they do that? Well, Serbia has intimated that it will go to war because the Serbians don't trust the Muslims. The Serbians had 600 years of fighting the Ottomans, and that's long memories. So there's no way that the Serbs are going to allow any greater Muslim area to develop, not in their backyard. And they've shown in the 1990s they're quite prepared to kill and massacre. I'm not just going to blame them because I think the whole thing is a complete dog's dinner. And I don't know who you'd blame, probably all of them to some extent. But nonetheless, the point is that Serbia has got a bit of a record here. And if it goes to war, if Serbia goes to war over Greater Albania, it's a complete nightmare for Europe. And that word's been used. I think Mr. Rama, the Prime Minister, said, if this goes pear-shaped, we have a nightmare in Europe. So what does this mean in terms of Daniel chapter 8? Again, purely speculating. But if Albania is threatened by, let's say, Serbia, Albania's main ally is, do you want to guess? Turkey. Albania is Muslim, Sunni Muslim in the main. Turkey, of course, is Muslim. They have an understanding. So if Albania is under threat, then Turkey, the he-goat, may get sucked in to defend it. And things could escalate, because if Serbia then felt under threat from a Turkish-supported Albania, guess who supports Serbia? That little country called Russia.
Yes.
So it wouldn't take very much imagination to see in the eastern part of Europe a Russian-supported Serbia at war with a Turkish-supported Albania. And that would easily spill over, because for the last roughly 1,000 years, Turkey and Russia have been enemies. Now, occasionally for, you know, a week or two, or a particular event, you might get Russia and Turkey appearing to be in agreement over something. It's very temporary, very transient. The Turks and the Russians have been at each other's throats for a millennium. So just imagine what would happen if you got Serbia and Russia against Albania and Turkey. So what I think you can imagine is very possibly a Balkan war would suck Turkey into it, leaving a vacuum, because if Turkey's got a lot of its men, its military, its attention on Albania and seeing off the Serbs and the Russians and then watching out for a Russian counterattack, then the Ram sees his chance. Iran sees his chance. Hang on. Turkey's preoccupied. In any event, we're not going to go into Western Turkey, to Istanbul or Ankara. All we're going to do really is go north to Azerbaijan, go south through Saudi into Yemen. We're going to occupy Iraq and Syria. We're going to take the eastern part of Turkey, but they won't mind too much, really. In any event, they're occupied. So therefore, there's a chance if we see a Balkan problem developing, and that creates a vacuum in Turkey, that's then what triggers Iran's invasion. And Iran will then rule the roost from the north to the south and to the west for a while, until the he-goat at Turkey sorts things out, gets back on its feet, and then launches this this blitzkrieg attack back on Iran, on the Ram. And leading it is their first king of Javan, potentially, of course, Mr. Erdogan, since once the Ottoman Empire is resurrected, he will be its first president, and the Sultan, and the Caliph. In fact, there have been a couple of Muslim theologians who said that the leader of the new Turkey will be essentially a caliph. They're already calling him that. So, some of that is obviously speculation, but I would suggest that if you pick up in the news in the next month or three or six or nine that there's big problems in the Balkan countries, if you pick up these little countries that you've never heard of, like Albania and Macedonia and Kosovo, and Montenegro, and you think, where are these countries? If there's problems there, I think we watch out, because that could well be the trigger, the domino that tips over, that gets Turkey involved, that releases Iran to attack, and then we're into Daniel 8 territory. We're into mega problems worldwide, because once the Persian Gulf catches fire with all this fighting, you can bet your boots that the world's economies, the dollar, life as you know it, as I know it, becomes very different for quite a while. So, I think we'll conclude more or less there, just saying it's worthwhile to keep watch. Especially, I would suggest, watch Recep Tayyip Erdogan. He wants to be the Sultan of the resurrected Ottoman Empire, and he's on track. This guy, he might get assassinated tomorrow, of course, in which case, ignore everything I've said. the point is that we know the narrative of Scripture. We look at world events. We do our best to responsibly interpret them, but we don't absolutely know for sure, do we? But we can watch. And my suggestion is, it's a suggestion, if you want to watch the Pope in the Vatican, have at it. I have no problems with that. It's curious that many Catholics and many cardinals seem to be suggesting that they don't think he is a Catholic. I'm not sure how you have a pope who's not a Catholic, but that's the view of quite a number of people in the Catholic hierarchy, that they've got a rogue pope. You can watch that. You can watch Europe. There's certainly plenty happening in Europe. Germany is certainly a very strong, dominant country. So no problems. You want to watch Europe, the Vatican, it's fine. But looking at Daniel chapter 8, looking at Revelation 13 and 17, and 18, and looking at the great whore that sits on a great city that sits in the desert. To me, everything just stacks up that we're looking at Turkey, Iran, Saudi Arabia, Mecca, Medina, and so on. I may be wrong, of course. But for now, I'll just say, keep an eye on Turkey, keep an eye on Mr. Erdogan, keep an eye on Iran, and just possibly, very speculatively, if the Balkans erupts anytime soon, that could be the gun firing for the end times. Well, I guess we'll see. Okay, with that, we'll conclude today's news update.